From wars to censorship to cultural issues, you're with Mark Morano and Unleashed on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome to Unleashed with Mark Morano, except it's not. It's me, Lambert Opik, just standing in for Mark for a couple of days. Thank you very much for joining me. I might be a different face, but the stories remain very similar. We talk about the big, weighty issues affecting the world. And you have the chance to be involved. Just go to tntradio.live and get involved in the chat. You'll also find the phone numbers there if you want to phone in, wherever you are in the world. There's a phone number for you. You don't have to agree. You don't have to disagree. You just have to have a point of view and have an opinion. That's the whole point of TNT, today's news talk. Our mission here is to share the facts as best we can establish them, and then our opinions too. But that's all for the purpose of enabling you to set out your opinions in your own mind. What I don't want to do is have any pretense of indoctrinating you. I'd love you to agree with my opinions, and you'll find out what they are over time. But at the same time, most importantly, it's the celebration and defense of free speech, something which, as I said yesterday on the Mark Morano show, is very much under threat. Today, we've got two absolutely fantastic guests over the next couple of hours. We've got Doug Bando, who is one of the great political heavyweights up on the Hill. He was a special assistant to President Ronald Reagan, and he writes for many magazines, including his own, which is the political magazine Inquiry. I'll tell you more about him in a minute. We'll be talking to him about US politics and also the inevitable and ongoing debate about what's happening in the Middle East. That affects all of us. And I think you're going to get some good insights from Doug. It follows naturally from the dialogue we had yesterday and from the limited developments we've seen today. In the second hour, we stay on the big politics as well. Dr. Shay Bradley will be joining me. She's a PhD and president of the Counterpoint Institute for Policy, Research and Education. I've always known that as CIPRE. She's a pretty prolific author, and it's a very important work that she's written. It's called Last Warning to the West, Hungary's Triumph Over Communism and the Woke Agenda. For anybody who's a little bit concerned about wokeism, about the virtue signaling, which seems to have taken over in many places from hard, objective political policymaking, she is an absolute must-see. I'll be talking with her not just about the current political situation, but about the long-term, what we call teleology, the direction of society and where it's going, and whether this obsession with woke, and I would include the environment, I'll come back to that in a moment, is doing us more harm than good. My view, of course, is that it is doing more harm than good, that the virtue signaling is, in fact, taking us away from objective policymaking. You may have a different view. Well, let's see what Dr. Bradley says about that. That's in the second hour. All of that with me, Lambert Opik, here for Mark Morano. Before we go to our first guest, let me talk about something which I've noticed and I've not been able to avoid over this last 24 hours. We've even covered it in the news here on today's News Talk TNT. Those are the flash floods in a normally fairly arid part of the world, namely Dubai. It's a place I'm very familiar with. I've done a lot of work there, and I've changed planes more times than I could ever count. Well, my general experience of Dubai is that you can go for a swim in the winter. I actually was swimming on around the 6th of January when I was there for an occasion, and the weather was pleasant, more than pleasant, and the water was as warm as a swimming pool. I wouldn't have imagined that it was going to have a heavy deluge, the type of which has been reported at least in the United Kingdom extensively and probably all over the world. But lo and behold, the heavens have opened and there has been flooding in a city unprepared for that kind of torrential rain. You'll see some very dramatic shots of cars and car parks underwater and drains which are not designed for storms, unable to cope with that influx of fresh water. Now, it does rain in Dubai. It's generally dependent on purifying water from the ocean, but it does rain. And so that's not the unusual thing. It's the amount of rain which fell there. They say a year's worth in just a day. Now, I haven't actually checked those figures, but let's assume it's true. That's all fact, as far as I can see. The next part I'm not so happy about. Of course, and inevitably, The reporters on the mainstream media, including the state-sponsored stations in the United Kingdom, have associated all of that with, you guessed it, you know what I'm going to say next, climate change. Well, okay, that's possibly, arguably correct if it happens again and again. If it doesn't, then it's just weather. If it's a one-off incident, then statistically speaking, it will happen from time to time. And that on its own is not climate change. There has to be a repeat and another repeat and another repeat of the same kind of weather before we can begin to say there's a significant change in the climate in Dubai. Otherwise, it is exactly that, just weather. And the weather changes. Anyone who lives in the United Kingdom or roughly the same latitude as the UK knows that the weather can change sometimes quite dramatically. I was once in the northern country of Estonia, where my parents come from, and we left in the morning. It was a parliamentary delegation, and we went to a place called Haapsalu, which is just by the Baltic Sea. When we arrived, it was plus 18 Celsius. When we left, it was minus 2. It changed in 2 hours. That was weather. It wasn't climate change. And no one was worrying about climate change there at the time. So that's my first point. It is interesting and very dramatic weather. But one incident cannot possibly be regarded as statistically important when you talk about climate change. Now, let's do a thought experiment here. Here's the second point. Let's assume it is climate change. Let's assume it does happen again and again. Let's work on the assumption that Dubai will be faced with far greater quantities of water, fresh water falling from the sky than it has done for decades or centuries. What then? Well, first of all, happy days for vegetation. Instead of having to artificially irrigate everything, they'll have to find a clever way to store the water and to get rid of the excess. Well, I'd have thought those of us who know that parts of, for example, the Sahara and Egypt and so forth were lush green pastures thousands of years ago will recognize the benefit, because sand doesn't support life like rainwater does. So actually, it could be pretty good news for Dubai if they finally get a great deal more water, because at the end of the day, Dubai is an artificial construct which depends on artificial freshwater production to feed and water its people and plants. So let's just ease down a little bit. I would say that Dubai is one of the places that would like a little more rain, perhaps not quite this much, quite so fast. But even then, they could probably manage it if they had a plan. Now let's go to the thorny issue of the climate change itself. If there is climate change, and let me stress again, it has to happen again and again for us to make that claim. But if it turns out that this is a recurring theme, then who caused it? Humans or nature? And this is when I get angry. The reportage I have seen on the old legacy media doesn't even question that human beings are responsible for the deluges in Dubai. Hold on a minute. Let's remember the statistics here. There's a carbon budget, the amount of CO2 that goes into the atmosphere and comes out. And that of that carbon budget, the amount of carbon dioxide generated every year, 3.5% of it is generated by humans. It might be as little as 1%. Maybe it's as much as 5%. But you get the idea. The other 96.5% comes from natural sources, vegetation and the oceans. You may not know this, but as oceans get warmer, they spit out carbon dioxide. It's a completely natural process. Just as when they get colder, they suck it in. It's just physics writ large on a planet which is covered 70% with ocean. So when you look at the statistics here, if there is climate change, it's very unlikely that the 3.5% of carbon dioxide, as works out as 40,000 million tons a year, by the way, if you're really interested in the statistics, generated by humans is going to make much difference compared to the roughly, this is a rough figure, 800,000 million tons of carbon dioxide generated by nature. But here's an even bigger point. Carbon dioxide can't be doing it. Carbon dioxide doesn't represent 10 or 8 or even 4% of the atmosphere. It represents 0.04%. That means, in simple terms, if you had 1 million golf balls and almost all of them were white, 420 of them would be red. That's one red golf ball for every 2,500 white ones. That's how much carbon dioxide there is in the atmosphere. It's surprisingly low. And actually, it's dangerously low, because if it goes below 150 parts per million, which is roughly a third of what we've got now, everything dies. Plants breathe carbon dioxide in the same way that humans breathe oxygen. Now, that's a pretty big difference, because for plants, it's a completely different process, but the principle's the same. And just as if humans don't get enough oxygen, we suffocate, so also if plants don't get enough oxygen, they suffocate too. And that threshold seems to be roughly a third of what we have now. We're actually only slightly above the minimum in the history of the Earth, which was about just under two-thirds of what we've got now. In my book, that's too close for comfort. I would love to see a doubling or a tripling of carbon dioxide. And don't worry, folks, if we do that, it's not going to warm the atmosphere much. Carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas, but it's not the main one. The main greenhouse gas, the one that really stops Earth from becoming a snowball, is water vapor. That's the stuff you drink. That's the stuff that makes the clouds. That's where the rain comes from. And at the equator, that's 90% more important than CO2. So my advice to all of you is enjoy the pictures from Dubai. Sorry if you got flooded, if you're listening and watching in Dubai, but fundamentally, all is good. If this happens another 30 times, I'll support the idea that this is true climate change. And I'll celebrate it. I might buy a place in Dubai, because I know I'm not going to have to water the garden. Put your thoughts and comments on that into the chat at tntradio.live, or call in as well if you like to. But coming up next, we're going to talk about the politics of the planet, probably not touching too much on the environment, but we'll see where we go. And next up is Doug Bando, who's with me in just a moment. All of that with me, Len Bitopic, standing in for Mark Morano on Unleashed.
Keeping the commitment 24/7.
I've been in the car all day and I got to listen.
Can't get enough of it.
You guys are doing a great job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Break. So let me introduce you to my first guest here on Unleashed, Mark Morano's show, with me standing in today. And it's Doug Bando. Doug, very much honored to have you on the show today. Thanks for joining us on today's News Talk, TNT.
Very happy to be on with you.
I apologize for not being Mark Morano, but I wouldn't, I would do anything. He's locked in a cupboard because I wanted to talk to you. Your credentials are phenomenal. After the break, we'll talk about the subjects, but just let's spend a few minutes learning about you. You knew possibly one of the most charismatic presidents in American history, Ronald Reagan. You actually worked with him one-to-one.
Yes, I worked in the presidential campaign and then in the White House. I don't want to oversell my credentials. I was pretty young then, but I was in the room with him a lot, usually a lot of other people too, but he knew who I was. And I have some very nice photos of my time on the campaign in the White House. He was quite a character and quite a president.
And he was often presented as something of a joke or just an actor in, for example, British media at the time. But he won that second term so conclusively. I remember seeing one of his election adverts, a party political broadcast, 25 minutes long, with him and George W. Bush. And I was persuaded. How heavyweight was he?
Well, he was quite serious. Now, he was not a big policy nerd in the sense of wanting to come up with all the details of a policy, but he read deeply. You can go to his ranch today. You see the books. You know, on the bookshelf, he read those. On the campaign, he would hand me articles, ask me if I had read them. And he liked to be underestimated. when he ran for governor of California for the first time, he was up against the head of the state legislature who wanted him to win. He won that election by 1 million votes, in a state that, in the presidential campaign, Jimmy Carter's people thought he'd be the easiest person to beat. He whumped them, in a big race. So this is a man who thought deeply about principle. He knew where he wanted to go, and he wanted others to come up with some of the details. But this is a thoughtful man. And like I said, he liked to be underestimated. His view was, you want to think he's a fool, go ahead. A lot of people have done that, and they usually lost.
I would like to say I would have enjoyed being underestimated, but that feeling stopped when I lost my seat in 2010 in British Parliament. So I have a different view now, Doug, I have to tell you. You yourself have a pretty impressive pedigree. You are the editor of Inquiry magazine. What's that about?
Well, it's no longer around, but I did that. It was a political magazine. It was kind of a classical liberal version, say, of the New Republic, Nation, those sorts, National Review, an all-around political magazine. We had a good time. The problem is the vagaries of financing for magazines aren't always easy. I went from there to the Cato Institute and had done my time kind of as a think tank person, working with other think tanks, working with candidates, writing for publications, and generally, trying to, telling people what I want them to do. They ignore me a lot, but I still get satisfaction out of, giving my opinion.
Well, you're going to get almost 40 minutes to give your opinion to the world with me on the Mark Morano Show in a moment, so don't go anywhere. After the break, I'm going to read some of the messages that you've put in about my commentary about what I believe is a non-existent climate change. I will read them without fear or favor, without editing and without argument, because I don't want to take time away from Doug. Do keep your calls and comments coming, though. I'll be speaking with Doug Bando about the political situation as he sees it in the US and beyond. All of that with me, Len Bitopek, standing in for Mark Morano here on Unleashed. I'll see you in a minute right here on TNT.
A better business tip from TNT Radio. The benefits of advertising on today's news talk, TNT Radio, should be clear to businesses of any shape or size. It can be accessed anywhere, anytime, by anybody, and is the perfect way to build brand awareness and stimulate digital activity. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
It's time to switch on
today's news talk radio.
Very entertaining.
Yeah! TNT.
Thank you very much for your calls and comments. Just to explain, if you've just joined us, I'm Len Bitopek, obviously, standing in for Mark Morano, obviously on Unleashed, obviously on TNT, very obviously. I'm with Doug Bando. We're going to be talking about politics, US and international in a minute. I provoked quite a lot of comments about it might be the non-existent climate change. Let me read some of the comments. I'm not going to comment on them. I'll just read them out. Weefat Chug says, mankind is responsible for about 3% of that 0.04% of CO2. Absolutely right. Those figures are pretty much undeniable. There's actually an argument that the current level of CO2, carbon dioxide, was roughly the same in 1800, but I haven't got time to explain why I say that. El Cid says, and this is just in anticipation of what I'll be discussing with Doug, did Cameron really need to fly to Tel Aviv when Bibi could have told him over the phone, go and do one? Okay, well, we'll find out what Doug thinks about that. We've had Chug. I know I quite like that one, Doug. I thought you'd enjoy that. We've had Chug goes on to talk about the environment again. Many believe that 280 parts per million is the point of no return, the part where we become extinct. We're at around 350 right now. Well, I would say it's 150 for the point of no return, and we're on 420 now. But the principle's the same. We're splitting hairs there, because I'd much rather have 1,200 parts per million. I'd rather triple CO2 and make sure the plants can breathe properly. Also, by the way, that would be a partial problem to hunger, because lots of parts of the world would be easier to farm. A few more here. We'll read this as good. Whatever the case, CO2 levels are too low already. It's not wise at all to diminish it further. Totally agree. El Cid suggests that Cameron's probably looking for Tony Blair, Minister for the Middle East, by flying over to Tel Aviv. It's interesting. No one really talks about Tony Blair. He's very silent. After having a war in Iraq, he doesn't seem to be around to stop a war again. I wonder why. He's more qualified to stop unnecessary wars than anybody else I know. And on that one, let me come back to you, Doug Bando. I'm allowed to express my opinions here as long as I don't dress them up as fact. I was an MP when the infinite wisdom of Washington and Westminster took us to war in Iraq on the basis of a bogus claim about weapons of mass destruction. Arguably, that did more to unsettle the Middle East than anything else that's happened. Where would you start if you were to chronicle the current issues that we're seeing in the Middle East, 1947 or more recently?
Well, I'd start at least in 1953, when both London and Washington helped push a coup d'etat in Iran that brought the Shah to power, because that is remembered in Iran. And that certainly, you know, the Shah was a modernizer, which we liked, but, you know, he was brutal as well. That helped give us the Iranian Revolution, which, of course, has given us a fount of problem. You know, Washington supported Saddam Hussein in the 1980s when Iraq invaded Iran. You know, well, you know, no surprise that Saddam thought that we'd stand by when he invaded Kuwait. You know, so all of that is there. You can go back to 47 and, you know, the creation of Israel. You know, the whatever one thinks of the creating Israel, one has to recognize that's going to unsettle the region. It's going to unload a lot of tensions. So today, all of those things are there. And frankly, we're paying a pretty high price. I think the Iraq war was a catastrophe. I think that George W. Bush and his crew got it absolutely wrong. And unfortunately, Tony Blair, you know, was a well-wisher and pushed them along. And that's one of the worst, among other things, it empowered Iran. You know, I mean, of all the things you'd think the U.S. would not want to do, it's come up with a policy that made Iran more influential, more powerful, and more dangerous.
Yes, I always regarded George Bush Sr. As a pretty serious political heavyweight. Yes. He hated broccoli, but apart from that, that's how closely I follow politics. Ten tons of broccoli dumped on the White House lawn by angry farmers because he said he hated broccoli.
Yes.
Actually, I have to admit, I respected George Bush Sr. because he came out in a press statement and said, I said I didn't like broccoli. I don't like broccoli. And I still hate broccoli, however much they pour onto my lawn. That's principled politics. But then you got George W. Bush, who, to use a British phrase, maybe an American one too, is a chip off the old block. But that's exactly what he is, just a tiny chip off the old block. And just in terms of him and his decision-making, we went from Bill Clinton and Blair, which seemed to be a strong and credible alliance, and before that, Reagan and Thatcher, which, whether you like the people or not, was clearly a special relationship to George W. Bush and sing-alonger Blair. But I don't know if you met him, but George W. Bush actually like?
Well, as a person, see, George W. Bush is the kind of person I'd like to have as my next door neighbor. I mean, imagine having a backyard barbecue. He would actually be a lot of fun. I mean, he was a decent human being. There are a lot of episodes of how he responded to wounded troops and other people that told you he was a nice person. But unfortunately, this was somebody who shouldn't have been president, that his decision-making, you know, the way he made his choices. He had very little interest in learning deeply about these issues. You know, he basically, if you didn't tell him what he wanted to hear, he'd, you know, view you as being an appeaser or something. And you know, he eventually, you know, at least turned some things around. The administration got better, you know, as it got, you know, longer on because of the experiences that it had. But Iraq showed us that, you know, the disaster that it was. And I think Afghanistan, you know, the U.S. had to go into Afghanistan, but trying to, you know, create democracy in Central Asia And so he jumps into Afghanistan and then leaves, you know, most of the troops, you know, to go after Iraq. I mean, all of this, you know, gave long-term problems, not only for the U.S., but for the U.K. and other European states that were helpful for the U.S. in those conflicts.
He did win a second term. I'm going into this background because I really want to kind of get to the perception that you have of the current situation. And then in the third part of the show, we'll talk about the immediate future. But he did win a second term, and quite decisively. Why was that?
Well, I'm not sure I'd call it decisive. I mean, it was a couple million votes. It was John Kerry, but a 200,000 vote swing in Ohio, Kerry would have won because of the American Electoral College system. I mean, the problem was Kerry was kind of a very typical, I mean, in America, we call them liberals, you know, but it's not really, I mean, not really European liberal, be much more left or progressive. And, you know, Kerry was vulnerable on some issues, and the Bush campaign were very, very effective at using an attack. I mean, you don't want to talk about Bush's record. You go after him. And my guess is if the election had been a year later, that there's a good chance he would have lost because, you know, in 1980, in 2004, it was evident Iraq wasn't going great, but it was still early enough that Bush could claim a success. By 2005 or six, I think everybody recognized what a disaster it was. So in that sense, Kerry was rather unlucky. You know, that, and Republicans have tended to do well in presidential elections. Congressional elections, they're not always so successful. But when Democrats nominate a weak candidate, somebody like Bush with political people around him knew how to take advantage.
Okay, so, he won. I suppose I used the word decisive because he won and no one ever contested it. Whereas
that's right. Yeah, there was no question like the previous time.
Yeah. That's what I'm really. That's what I think of it as uncontroversial, and yet. So he did the intervention in Afghanistan. We had the problems in Iraq. Both of them, I have to say, both of them extremely dubious, not least because we caused a rod for our own back in Afghanistan, without going too deeply into the history, by essentially training the Mujahideen, led by, you may have heard of him, Osama bin Laden, who was our ally. And then we walk away from it. There's a film called Charlie Wilson's War, which isn't far from the truth.
And that's right.
So all of this is going on. And I wonder if, you've written for Washington Post, everything really. So you're a very hugely credible person on this. I wonder if the actual seeds for the current destruction of our peaceful world were sown around then with the Iraq intervention, with the Afghanistan intervention, with the Western-sponsored Arab Spring, which turned into something of an Arab winter.
Well, that's right. The problem, you know, is if people talk about, well, we have to be involved because look what might happen if we're not involved. And my reaction is look at the last 20 or 30 years. It's the involvement that's so destabilizing. I mean, Saddam Hussein was a bad character, but blowing up Iraq, look what it brought us. And, you know, we still deal with those consequences. Even today, Iraq is hardly a liberal democracy. It has all sorts of warring militias. You know, these groups are allied with, of all countries, Iran. They fire missiles at Americans, you know, who are on duty in Syria. And why we're in Syria is very hard to understand. You know, you look at this and you just think about this manipulation of trying to, you know, put together where we went into Syria thinking, well, we can overthrow Assad, who hates ISIS, but okay, at the same time, we're going to defeat ISIS. And we'll do that by working with the local Al-Qaeda affiliate. Now, Al-Qaeda those are the people who attacked America. Okay, but in this case, they're our friends. And you just sit here and you start watching this. And then we're going to work with the local Kurds who the Turks hate. So Turkey won't let us use bases for this operation. Instead, they invade and they attack the people the U.S. is working with. I mean, you just sit here and you think this is mind-blowingly stupid. Where even somebody smart, kind of like an Obama, I suppose, can't make it work. But George W. and his crew, I mean, oh my goodness, you know, forget it.
You remind me of the fact that George W. Bush choked on a pretzel, which doesn't make him stupid, but it didn't help his public reputation. He seemed to vacillate when he first heard the news of the 9/11 attack. And then he had Dan Quayle, his vice president, who couldn't even spell potatoes. As he famously showed. If viewers haven't seen it, just put in Dan Quayle potatoes. You'll
No. Yeah, he corrected a school student who and told him he was spelling it correctly and told And, well, there are other stories about
Dan Quayle. He goes up to the blackboard and changes it. Incredible, yeah. Dan Quayle. incidentally, our viewers are responding. Holly says, hello. Good evening, Holly, by the way. My fellow Pelicans. I don't know if he ever said that, but he says, Dawn Stupid Bush was the endless theatre. Hemingway, this isn't quite directly relevant, but I'll read it anyway because I'll forget if I don't now, Doug. Good evening, Lambert. Hope you had a good National Banana Day, or maybe you know it better as International Bat Appreciation Day. It's what April the 17th has become. Hemingway, I fear that you're being literal. I fear those are real things.
It's certainly possible. It's everything.
It's frighteningly possible. Red says this, had to go into Afghanistan. I think that's the line you said, Doug. Had to get the opium, you mean, having fallen out with the Mexican cartels. I think Red's being a bit cynical there. But I would agree with the first part of what he was asking there. Now, once again, you've been very intimately involved in the politics of America. Did we really need to go into Afghanistan, or could we just let that sleeping dog lie?
Well, I think one of the problems is who's we. It's not at all clear to me that Europe should have followed. That is, that I think what the U.S. needed to do was to punish the Taliban for hosting training camps of Al-Qaeda. But it doesn't strike me that then you also want to go on and think we're going to bring democracy to Afghanistan. I mean, anyone who studies history would certainly know the British experience. And let's just say it was not the easiest or the most pleasant. You know, and to imagine, I mean, I visited Afghanistan twice. I once went on a trip my think tank organized. I once went with a NATO trip. And what you go there and you realize that this is completely hopeless. There are really good people at the time in Kabul who wanted a liberal society, but you know, it's rural Afghanistan, and the U.S. Turned it into a war, a battleground, and lost the hearts and minds of people there. And that went on for 20 years. It just tells you that. That to me was the huge mistake, that it was you punish the Taliban, make clear you can't do this to us, but then you leave and you accept the fact that it'll be something different, but it could be Mujahideen, it could be Taliban, it could be whatever it is, for the most part won't matter much.
And so we find ourselves staggering from one international conflict to another, with the United Kingdom always in tow behind the United States policy, partly for understandable reasons and partly not. And now we see the whole thing again with Benjamin Netanyahu hell-bent on destroying Hamas, however much he's ignoring the lessons of history there, and beginning to generate this mutual provocation with Iran, which is a regional superpower. Adding everything we've talked about so far on the program, Doug, isn't the massive big red arrow pointing towards danger here? Because we haven't got it right for the last 50 years.
Yeah, the United States had a TV show years and years ago when I was young, Lost in Space. And the famous scene was the robot would come showing up saying, danger, danger, Will Robinson, danger, danger. And that my reaction is that's what we need today, is someone coming on saying, danger, danger. This is extraordinarily dangerous. You know, whatever you think of Israel, the Netanyahu government is probably the most extreme in its history. You look at people who are in power with him. You know, these are people who are provoking settlers in the West Bank who are on a rampage using violence. And Netanyahu needs to stay in government because he's worried about going to jail over charges of corruption. So for him, staying in power, is advanced by war. You know, he knows that if an election was held, he would lose. So you have a government that its own incentives are very dangerous, in the sense that what does he want to do? It wouldn't surprise me that he attacked the diplomatic, facility of Iran because he thought it would provoke them. And his hope was that it would provoke them enough that it would bring the U.S. and Europeans into the war on his side. And this is something where the U.S. and Europe want to stay as far away from that as they can. You know, Israel has a very strong military. If they want to get into a war, they have the means to do so. But there's no reason for the rest of us to come in behind them and get caught up. You know, this would not be something that would end tomorrow. I mean, this would simply be there'd be new rounds in the future that none of us can predict.
Yeah, a friend of mine recently, who I hadn't seen for a long time, said to me, in reference to pretty much what you've just said about the Middle East, Doug, he said, where you went wrong, Lambert, in the 2010 general election is you didn't declare war on the neighboring county of Shropshire. But I didn't have the resources, Doug. And America wasn't going to send me $50 million, $1 billion like they have to Zelensky, which we'll talk about in just a minute. Before we go to a break, because I really want to talk about the Russia-Ukraine situation with you in the next part of the show, what's your prediction? Because Netanyahu seems to be slightly hesitating now, and even sleepy Joe Biden seems to have reckoned that it wouldn't be the most brilliant political and strategic decision on the planet to start having a full-scale war with Iran.
My hope is that what Netanyahu will do is will be a strike, in many ways like the Iranian strike. It looks big, but in practice doesn't do a lot of damage. Because that way, both countries can kind of work out the national ego and show that they're somebody, and then hopefully move on. Because frankly, Israel doesn't want to have a war with Iran, as well as problems in the West Bank, as well as war in Gaza, potentially having Hezbollah start shooting off thousands of missiles from Lebanon. That's not in Israel's interest either.
Yeah. Yes, indeed. The lessons of history repeat again and again the danger of fighting a war on two fronts. After the break, Doug, I want to talk about the thorny issue of Ukraine, where Zelensky seems to have a limitless demand for funds and Washington seems to have tired of it. But let's talk about that in just a moment. You're watching Lembotopic, standing in for Mark Morano here on Unleashed, in today's News Talk TNT. I'm talking to Doug Bando, who has got an enormous pedigree in terms of appearing on international and American broadcasting. He's an accomplished academic, and also he's an accomplished editor. We'll be talking about the difficulties just on the borders of Europe between Russia and America and NATO in just a minute. All of that with me, Lembotopic, here on the Mark Morano Show on TNT. I'll see you in a minute.
I was such a young age. Everything changed. My name is Chloe. When I was 13, my dad was diagnosed with cancer. When I found out, I just didn't know how to react. I felt like everything was just kind of closing in on me. It just became a routine, dad's doing chemo. I'd come home from school, wait for mum to finish work, and we'd go straight to the hospital, spend a few hours there, just draw. It was hard to navigate going to school, hundreds of kids, and I was the only one with a dying dad. He was diagnosed in March. And then he died in October. Towards the end, I heard about canteen. It kind of felt nice to know that they had other people like me. They understood what I was going through, and we didn't even have to chat about cancer. In 2020, I became a youth ambassador, so I can help others the way they helped me. I've done so many things since I was 13. I've graduated high school, university, gotten my license, made a move across the country. Life now is just a whole lot more fun. Please give a gift today to support more young people like me experiencing cancer.
Most people are unaware that bad bacteria can grow quickly in food that's stored, prepped, or cooked incorrectly, and that can lead to food poisoning. To avoid bad bacteria, always make sure your hands and cooking utensils are clean. Keep raw meat and chicken away from food that won't be cooked. Run your fridge at or below 5 degrees Celsius and use a meat thermometer to ensure your meat's being cooked to at least 75 degrees Celsius. For more tips on keeping bad bacteria at bay, visit foodsafety.asn.au.
Taking no prisoners, this is Unleashed with Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Mark Morano Show with me, Lembotopic, standing in just for a couple of days for Mark here on Unleashed. Still with me, we've got the incomparable Doug Bando, not least incomparable because he does laugh at some of my jokes, which is great. Thanks very much indeed, Doug. The other thing that Doug has got is an insight, which I'm finding very helpful and very accessible too. Before we go back to Doug, though, some of your comments here. George W. Bush is apparently 20 IQ points higher than the persona he projects, says Tequila Dead Man. Holly, it says it's all theatre. We've had Chuck says, does he smell of sulfur? Okay. Yeah, the dark side is being hinted at there, I think. Hemingway says, beware, my friend, because tomorrow, April the 18th, is National Velociraptor Day. So watch out for those pesky dinosaurs sneaking up on you. It's also International Amateur Radio Day, which, of course, doesn't apply to you. Thank you, Hemingway. I'm not sure if you're being sarcastic. Doesn't translate well. But I've got breaking news. Oh, hang on, one more here. Mingling a ding dong, still one of my favorite handles on the chat. On the 13th of November, sorry, on November 6th, 2013, South Park episode, The Ginger Cow, tells you all about the heifer prophecy. That's obscure. Maybe I've just sent a message to all the sleepers in the world by reading that out. I don't know. But here's
there is biblical prophecy of red heifers having to appear before. Yes, there is something there. Yes.
Really? I didn't realize that. Yeah. Okay, I'll have to follow that up later.
Yeah, that's very esoteric stuff.
Who knew? I'm impressed. I feel even more humble behind your learned intellect now. Just a bloke says, Netanyahu is doing a Margaret Thatcher who used the Falkland War to raise her failing and falling popularity. That is interesting and true. Red says, there's absolutely no justification for military intervention in any of these countries, and it's a disgrace. Holly adds, no one ever learns the lessons of history. And Red adds, shameful US-UK history of completely unjustified military interventions. But breaking news for you, Doug. I did check during the break. Today is National Banana Day. It really is. 17th of April.
I'll buy some bananas. I mean, I don't want to be out of step.
I've got some. They'll probably be sold out today, obviously. They'll be sold out. And in 2 days' time, Friday the 19th, is National Garlic Day.
Oh, my goodness. Gee, that's wonderful. Wonderful news.
I love garlic. Does it deserve a day? Okay. Asparagus.
Maybe
must
a couple hours. How about a couple hours?
A couple of hours would be fine. Just have a National Pungent Vegetable Day. That's what we
yes,
have.
Yes, that's
instead,
right.
And just have all the fruit together, but maybe that's fruitist, who knows? Right. So let's get back to this. Now, I want to talk about time goes so quickly, but the big issue, we've touched on it already, Ukraine, America, Russia. Some say this is yet another proxy war, which the West is bound to lose, because once again, we've committed the three massive offenses. Number one, incredibly long supply chains versus a really short supply chain for Russia. Number two, a very inconsistent level of commitment, which leads the other side to think they have to wait. And number three, a failure to understand the core issues. What's your take on the situation?
Well, I think that's quite correct. I mean, there's a fundamental problem here where this issue is existential for Russia, while for the West, it simply isn't. As much as one might want to help Ukraine, you know, the difference in terms of commitment is always going to be there. And while Russia did badly initially, they've learned their lesson that as badly as that military did, you know, these folks have figured things out. They've gotten much better and they have a huge manpower advantage. They have an industrial advantage. You know, so it's very hard for Ukraine to keep up. And in the West, you know, after 2 years, you know, it turns out there's no quick victory. And people are looking at the costs. You know, much of the cost of sanctions have fallen on the West, you know, not on Russia. And you know, Europe as well as the US have our own budget problems. People are looking at what appears to be an endless amount of money going to Ukraine. And while I understand Ukraine's desire to get everything back, the notion that they're going to be able to take Donbass and Crimea back, I think, is a fantasy. And if they really were able to do so, that would risk major escalation by Russia. I think the notion that the Russians would stand by and lose Crimea is just a fantasy. So this is a moment, frankly, what we need there is peace, not promoting endless war.
My opinion is that that's a pretty good assessment. NATO has also actually broken some promises that it made to Russia. You don't have to dislike Putin or like Putin to recognize that NATO has been totally disingenuous in its behavior.
That's right.
Do you want to explain in your terms how I know how I would describe it, but interesting to hear how you describe the NATO's disingenuous actions there.
Yeah, what I tell people is, you know, Vladimir Putin made the decision for war, and that's on him. So I don't want to, you know, suggest I'm justifying what he's done. He's a bad guy. But it's important to understand. And you can go back to the declassified records, and what we find is multiple assurances, both to Gorbachev and his officials, and Yeltsin, the first president of an independent Russia, and his officials. And the consistent message was NATO would not expand. And the Russians made very, very clear that for them, this was a red line. You know, the current CIA director, William Burns, was ambassador to Russia in 2008 when you had the Georgian War. And he sent a famous cable back to George W. Bush, who we were just talking about, saying that there was essentially no one in the Russian elite who would view the expansion of NATO to Ukraine as anything but a direct challenge to Russian, you know, interests. And he's no Putinist. I mean, this wasn't a Putin talking point. This was him explaining that this is a widely held opinion in. And there are a lot of analysts, intelligence analysts, CIA and others, who warned that expansion of NATO to Ukraine was likely to lead to violence. And there's a unique role that, you know, Putin views Ukraine playing. So we cannot act as if we are surprised that he went to war. It's terrible he did, but it was very well known among those who studied the issue that this was a huge issue in Russia, and Putin decided to make it an issue of war, which is a great tragedy.
And so I think the figure I've seen, and it could be wrong, you can correct me, that's been given to Ukraine for this war is something like $118 billion, $118,000 million, really for no return. And I'm wondering if all Putin needs to do is wait. He's pretty much one man band. He'll take advice from some people, I'm sure, but he doesn't need to worry about re-election for a long, long time, if ever. And meanwhile, we've got Biden worrying about Trump. Trump saying, I can get peace in Ukraine in 24 hours. And nobody really knowing what he means by it, but knowing that he is mates with Putin. And I'm wondering if Putin's strategy just has to be to wait, keep throwing troops at it, being willing to get quite a lot of collateral damage there, but just wait until the West gets bored and worries about other things.
I think that Putin's view is that he's winning. And I think that we really saw that with the failure of the counteroffensive by Ukraine. The Ukraine kind of shot its bolt. It used up a lot of troops, lost a lot of good people, trained manpower. It used up a lot of equipment, didn't get very far. And they don't have the kind of fortifications that the Russians do. So the Russians have been moving forward. And I think what Putin recognizes is he has a much larger manpower base. So he's going to have, you know, if the West is not going to go to war with him, he's always going to have more soldiers. And what we find is it turns out that neither Europe nor the United States actually has much production capacity. So the Russians can produce 4, 5, 6 times as many artillery shells in a year than the NATO members can. And then they get assistance from people joked about, oh, he's going to North Korea. But of course, if North Korea can provide 1 million artillery shells, that's to Putin's advantage. You know, it turns out he knows how to play this, and he's gone to, you know, Iran. He gets missiles and drones from Iran. Well, it turns out the missiles and drones work pretty well. So I think he's convinced that he is winning. So even if the money came, it's not clear what they could buy, you know, that the West doesn't have these weapons available. So the next year, at least, I think the Ukrainians, you know, they will be desperate to survive.
The Pope has suggested to Zelensky it might be time to surrender. Pretty big statement. Meanwhile, others are wavering, saying, why are we doing this? We've seen this so many times before. If you were to sum up what advice you would give the current president of America or the future one, who I suspect won't be the same as the current one, what would you tell this president or the next they should do in regard to Zelensky's relentless demand for investment in his war?
Well, what I'd say is that it almost certainly this war will end in some kind of a negotiation or in surrender of Ukraine, and that the allies can help make sure it's the first, not the second. What that means is acting now and not waiting for a defeat. And then I think you want the U.S. and the Europeans, number one, is they need to talk very seriously with Zelensky and say, you're not getting what you want out of this. And you're never going to be able to take back Crimea. They need to talk very seriously with Zelensky and say, you're not getting what you want out of this. And you're never going to be able to take back Crimea. So you've got to be thinking now of how do you salvage a peace agreement that may leave you neutral militarily, but leaves you with free political institutions and a freedom economically to go to the West, which I think that they could get. That's essentially what Putin wanted ahead of time. And then you go to Putin and say, okay, what will it take to end this? And in part of this negotiation should be, we shouldn't be confiscating Russian assets. We should be using those as an inducement. We're prepared to deal. If you are prepared to leave an independent Ukraine, we will assure you it never comes into NATO. But part of the agreement is you don't interfere with its domestic institutions. And then you talk about, we're prepared to give your money back. That kind of a thing that you say, what kind of an agreement can we come to? And I won't guarantee that that'll work, but I think we're, you know, Ukraine's in a better position today than it may be in say 3 or 6 months if there's a major summer offensive by the Russians and they take significantly more territory. The longer we wait, I'm afraid that Ukraine, number one, a lot more Ukrainian casualties. I mean, a lot of people in Washington view this as, isn't it great? We can fight Moscow by using Ukraine. We'll fight to the last Ukrainian and we'll weaken the Russians. Well, I don't see that as being in Ukraine's interest. Ukraine's interest is to preserve a relatively free society and the lives of its people. How do we all do that? I think we need to be looking for the exit. We should be looking for it now. We shouldn't be waiting.
Doug Bando, so much to thank you for here. We'll have you back pretty soon to see how your predictions work out and whether you got the right to say I told you so. So grateful. Have a great rest of the day. That's Doug Bando, who's a totally accomplished a reporter and commentator on these matters. He's written for everything, including his own magazine, Inquiry, right through to Fortune, Wall Street Journal, Washington Times. I wonder what you think about that. Do put your calls and comments into the chat. I'll read some of them now. There seems to be quite a lot of dialogue about National Banana Day. I'll come back to that in a minute. But let me go back to what Red said. Shameful US-UK history of completely unjustified military intervention. Seems to me that there is a repeating cycle, Red, and we don't tend to come out of it too well. It's not a comfortable thing to admit because thousands of lives and billions or trillions of dollars are spent getting nowhere. The actual total figure, the highest figure I've seen for investment in the Ukraine side of the war is $380 billion. That's a third of $1 trillion plus. Depends how you measure it, really. But in direct aid, something like $120,000 million of military aid. Hemingway says, Donald Trump revealed last week that he often calls up President Putin and has a good laugh about supposed Russian collusion. The last call I made to Vlad was a perfect phone call, said Trump. A tremendous phone call, one of the best uses of the device in the history of mankind. I'm really just good with a phone. I suspect anyway he made that up, but I don't know, because the truth is sometimes stranger than fiction in our world at the moment. I didn't know about National Banana Day, so it could be true, or National Garlic Day either. A couple more here. Basically, there's a comment. There's quite a lot of dropping off a yacht is a suggestion from Holly. I'm not sure that's legal, but I see your point. That doesn't mean that I'm supporting that kind of rather direct action. Never going to catch just a bloke, though. He says you wouldn't see me on one. No sea legs. Okay, well, that's all idea. You'll fall off if you've got no sea legs. I don't think the Russians care too much about frozen assets, to be honest, says Wee Fat Shug. And there is a huge amount of debate about National Banana Day. I can't say how many of you have commented about it, but Holly's right. Yes, I love garlic. I smell of garlic half the time. I spend too much time alone. So perhaps I'm more inclined to celebrate National Garlic Day than National Banana Day. I think there's a national day for just about everything. What we're going to be discussing next, though, is national none of those days. We're going to be talking about a fascinating subject, and it's characterized by the title of the book that this author we're discussing with next wrote, Last Warning to the West, Hungary's Triumph Over Communism and the Woke Agenda. What does that mean? To what extent are we signing our own cultural death warrant by woking ourselves out of the mainstream, by handing the keys of political power to others who are more pragmatic. Well, we'll be talking to Dr. Shay Bradley about all of that in just a moment or two. Do keep your calls and comments coming. I'll read as many of them out as I can. Probably not too many more about National Banana Day. I think we've peeled that one as far as it's going to go. Remember, I'm Len Bitopic, standing in for Mark Morano here on Unleashed on today's News Talk TNT. But this is your show. This is your space. Let me know what you think and whether I agree or disagree as best I can fit them in. I'll put in your calls and comments. All of that with me, Len Bitopic, here on Mark Morano's show, Unleashed on today's News Talk. I'll see you in a minute.